Okay, let's start with the algebra lectures. So let me start with a few logistics. So my name is Anna. Hi, everyone. You have already received my emails, I guess, so you know where to email me. Okay, a couple of things. There is a wiki page. I suppose you already know that. So please check there for material of the course. If you have any problem with the wiki page, if the problem is of the sort, you told us that the tutorial is on the wiki page and it's not, please email me. If the problem is of the sort, I cannot log into the wiki or I can, you know, this link is broken and so on, please email help@pi. Do you know this? You just. It's something like help, you know, at Perimeter and so on. So please send an email there whenever you have a problem with the wiki. And feel free to contribute to the wiki. So if, for example, you take notes from the lectures that you want to share with other people, put them there. If you want to start a discussion, if you want to upload a nice solution that you wrote to one of the exercises, feel free to do that. And last thing is, if you have questions in between the lectures, so if you go home tonight and you think about a question about today's lecture, please email me that question so that I can, you know, I can prepare a good answer for the next lecture. Okay. Good. So okay, so a small outline of the course. So we will first do a very short review of linear algebra and also of group theory. So I hope that we can do this today and then talk about finite groups today. And tomorrow we should start with infinite groups and Lie groups. And perhaps the main part of this course will be on Lie groups and Lie algebras. So I forgot, I have lecture notes. So if you can pass this around, please. Thanks. So these notes are basically definitions that I'm going to take for granted. So, you know, as we start with linear algebra, I would like to avoid writing the definition of a vector space, for example, on the blackboard. I think this is something that all of you know already. So yeah, it's nothing more than that. Don't take it too seriously. Okay, so why do we care about these topics? Let's start thinking. I usually start this course talking about quantum mechanics. So in quantum mechanics, usually we describe our system by a wave function. Which is nothing by a vector in a Hilbert space. Let me call this psi. Okay, and then when we talk about physical observables, this corresponds to two operators. And you know that this must be Hermitian operators. So that they have real eigenvalues. And physical information is encoded in probabilities. So, for example, if I am interested in studying the process, some state psi 1 evolves to a state psi 2. Then I should be calculating a scalar product like that. So what is important here is that our Hilbert space also has a scalar product defined on it. And I'm using here Dirac's notation, so you might want to think of this. This means the scalar product between the state psi 1 and the state psi 2. We will come back to this. Okay, and now, an important topic that often comes often people talk about in physics is symmetry. So what is symmetry? Symmetry is a change in our point of view that actually leaves the physical information invariant. So it should be something that leaves probabilities invariant. So if I change my states into some new states, psi prime, this should be a transformation U that has a property say ij here. Right, so that the probability that a state psi I changes into psi j is the same as the probability that the new state psi I changes into the new state psi j.
Isn't too restrictive to ask that the inner product remains the same instead of asking square modulus
You're
of the
right.
inner product?
I should be really asking that the square modulus remain the same. You're right in that. Very good. And actually, from here, you can see that in order for this relation to be true, this operator U must be either unitary and linear or anti-unitary anti-linear. So I'm guessing that the first option is what you have mostly seen so far. The second option is also an option. But if we are interested in transformations that contain the identity in them, this is the case we want to consider. Now, let's think. Let's think of combining two transformations. So if I start changing psi I into psi I prime through a transformation, let's say U1, and then I apply a second transformation U2, then obviously the final state can be written as U2 U1 on psi I. And if this still is a state that contains the same physical information that the original state contained, then the product of the two operators must again be a U transformation that is either unitary and linear or anti-unitary and anti-linear. So this must be a U3. Which means that these transformations must actually form a group. Well, to prove that they actually form a group, we need to see that the identity is contained here and that there exists an inverse for every element in the group, but we'll see this in more detail later. So very good. So already in quantum mechanics, we need linear algebra to describe our states. And then when we talk about transformations on our states, then we are already interested in group theory. Now, let's make the observation that the identity is such a transformation. Very good. And it is, and the identity is unitary and linear, of course. So any group that is continuously connected to the identity must be unitary and linear. Very good. And this is what brings us to Lie groups. This is why we are interested in Lie groups, and this will be the most important topic in these lectures. And as we will see, Lie groups can it is easier to study them through their algebra, and this is why we will be doing Lie algebras. Question? So the idea is that the identity is an element in the group, and then you can somehow the group elements depend on a set of parameters, and if I change my parameters by very, very, very little close to the identity, I will still find a group element, right? So if I start from the identity and I move a little bit far away from it, then I'm still in the group. And if I repeat this many times, enough times, I will actually find any group element that I am interested in. This is the formal definition of a Lie group. This is... let's say any group. So let's say any group whose elements are continuously connected to the identity. Is this clear? We will come back to this. I'm just trying to motivate why we're talking about all these things to start with. Although I'm sure that most of you have already seen this in your physics courses. Okay, so let's start with a quick review of linear algebra. Okay, and let me just mention the basic words that I want to be using here. So we're talking about a vector space. Let's call it V, and I'm going to use Dirac's notation for vectors, so x, y, and so on are vectors in this vector space. There is a set of vectors that are linearly independent and form a basis for this space, and let's label those as EI, where the index I should take values from 1 to n, where this should be equal to the dimension of the vector space. I'm going to assume that there is a well-defined scalar product in this space. And let me also mention the dual space V star. And now here, I want to actually write the definition of this. So this is the space of all maps that take us from V to the complex number. So for now, we're assuming that this is a vector space over the complex numbers. And I think it's worth talking about the dual space for a little bit. So if this is all we know, what is the only map we know that takes us from the vector space to the complex numbers? So out of what I've written here, there is only one map. It's the scalar product. Very good. It's our scalar product. And let's be a little more precise. And let's say that I am interested in this specific map. I'm going to denote it by covector size. So this map takes any vector x in the vector space and takes it to the scalar product between y and x. So I pick one vector, in particular y, and I construct this map for all other vectors, x. Let me also use this notation just to be clear. This is the map. This is the symbol I'm using for the map, acting on a vector. And this belongs, of course, to V star, and it is called the covector dual to the vector y. Very good. Now that we have this, we can define a dual basis. So by definition, the dual basis is the set of covectors. Let's call them W, I, and soon you will see why I choose to have an upper index here and a lower index there. And these are by definition the vectors that, when acting on the vector space basis vectors, give us 1 if I and j are the same index and 0 if they are different. Very good. One more definition that is very useful is the adjoint of an operator. let's call it A dagger. And A dagger is defined so that when I take the scalar product between X and A dagger acting on Y, this is the same as the scalar product between Y and the operator A acting on X, complex conjugate.
Yeah. Question. Maybe it's a little bit of this, but when you define the dual basis, you're assuming we are in a finite dimensional vector space, which implies that the dual has the same dimension, right?
You're right. This would be definitely the dual basis has the same dimension as V, and for now, yes, I am talking about finite dimensional vectors,
so
vector spaces, yeah.
In the case where I have infinite dimensional vector spaces, how can I define the dual basis without being redundant? To...
So, yeah, I mean, you. I guess you could make this, somebody said continuous parameter. Somebody, yeah. You could make this index a continuous parameter and then generalize this to a.
Because then it's a d omega.
But. So the product is well defined even if it is infinite dimensional. So what do you have in mind?
B and B star are isomorphic to each other.
I think so, yes.
In the case of the process.
If when there is the same dimension.
No, if it's in infinite dimension.
Not necessarily.
It would be... Okay, good question. I have to answer that tomorrow.
You should be able to construct an
L1 and L
infinity,
for example.
Is their dual uncomplicated infinite? Yeah, an example would be L infinity is the dual space of L1, which, at the very least, they don't have an isometric isomorphism.
Okay.
Okay. We can discuss this later. Let's assume for now that this is finite. So we have a finite end there. Okay. Oh, one more thing I wanted to say there. Just be careful. A and A dagger, they both belong to the dual vector space, and they both act on vectors. They don't act on covectors. Okay, I'm just saying this because. Often people get confused. Okay, and we've already mentioned Hermitian operators when we were talking about observables in quantum mechanics. So these are operators that have real eigenvalues, and they also have orthogonal eigenstates. So once we have a Hermitian operator, it is very convenient to find our spectrum of states in terms of the eigenstates of this operator, because these are going to be orthogonal. And we will be doing this when we study representations of Lie algebras. And something else we already mentioned, a unitary operator is an operator U such that its adjoint is the same as its inverse. Okay. another useful topic is a matrix representation of a vector space. So we are going to represent vectors, or what we know as kets in Dirac's notation, by columns, a column vector. Bras are going to be line vectors. And operators, linear operators, will be matrices. So if I have this basis EI for my vector space, I can write any vector psi. I can expand it in this basis. As the sum of some coefficients times the basis vectors. And here I am assuming summation over the indices I. And I guess this is the right time to ask, has everybody seen this before? If anybody hasn't seen it, can you raise your hands now? Okay, so this is the same as this. So whenever we have two indices that are repeated, we actually imply a sum over the indices, unless we explicitly write that this is not a sum. It just makes the notation more more compact. I could also write this as, in matrix notation, I could put all the basis vectors in a line vector, and all the components in a column vector. So in the basis EI, we can represent psi by this column vector, and we say that these are the components, or the components of psi in this basis. And note that. And if we change the basis, the components of vectors, we say that they transform contravariantly. So this is something that you will see later on in the year, but I think it's worth mentioning now already. So the usual convention is that when the index is up, it denotes some components that transform in this specific way. Basically, the way that this transform defines what this transformation means. Okay. Let us define one more thing here. Let us define a metric as the scalar product between two basis vectors. So this is the indices I and j here take, again, values from 1 to n. Now, if this is if this is a real vector space, so if the if this scalar product actually is a real number, then you can see that the metric is symmetric in its two indices. This is, and actually, this is probably the only case when we define a metric. Now, let us also define the inverse metric. And we define this as an object with two indices up so that so here again, summation is implied over the two J indices. Maybe I can write it for a last time. So this is how the inverse metric is defined. Using the metric and the inverse metric, we can start from an object with an index up or an index down and raise or lower this index. So we define, for example, psi I with an index down to be the product of the metric times psi with an index up. And you can check that this is equivalent to saying psi with an index up is the same as the inverse matrix multiplying psi with an index down. So the metric lowers an index, the inverse metric raises an index. In the same way, starting from our basis vectors, which we have been denoting with an index down so far, we can define EI with an index up to be equal to the inverse matrix multiplying a basis vector. And now let's do an easy calculation, which is calculate the scalar product between EI and EJ. So let me go through this. Sorry. Sorry, what did I want to do? This was wrong. This is how we define them. Very good. So let me just use this notation to be even more clear. This is the scalar product between EI and EJ. These are two vectors. Actually, the first one is a linear combination of basis vectors, and the second one is a basis vector. So this is the same as GIK EK EJ. So here I'm using the property that the scalar product is antilinear in its first argument, but actually I have assumed here that this is real. So that GIJ is real, and so is the inverse metric, right? And by definition, this is just GIK times GKJ, because this is how we defined the metric. This is a scalar product between two basis vectors. And through the definition of the inverse matrix, this is just a delta ij. But now if you compare this to the definition of the dual basis vectors, which is somewhere up there. You see that EI You see that EI is a dual basis vector. So this is something that we just define through raising an index. And it turns out that this is exactly the dual basis vector. Question, yeah.
So usually, I would think that when you have the bra, that means that the vector by itself is transformed contravariantly. But when you add the index, the I index to it, so are you reiterating that fact, or could you have a ket that transforms covariantly by having the down I as well?
Because maybe the question has a few parts. So usually we say that bras or covectors transform covariantly. So this is the covariant object. And this is the so-called contravariant object. Can you mix them? Is that the question? If you can mix them, if you can create objects that transform in both ways, or sorry.
All I was saying was basically, so either we use the ket to imply that it's covariant, or just the psi with the upper I to indicate that it's covariant,
You're right. All I'm saying is that, I wanted to say this in terms of representations. So when we're talking about vectors, it's the vector we are interested in. Now, when we are talking about a specific representation, you can think of, because you have specified your basis, and then you can think of the components of your vector as, you know, the object you are interested in, right? So then you talk about the components transforming one way or the other. Is this clear, or did I misunderstand the question?
I think the question is, can you have a thing with
a ket with a lower index? That's no,
by definition, this is the covector dual to this vector. So this is just notation. I mean, I'm just saying I have a vector E1, and then I define this covector to be the map that takes any x to the scalar product between E1 and x. Right. This is what we mean by definition. Yeah.
So here, one only has an indexing property. Does not indicate the transformation.
Exactly. It doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't. Yeah.
I have a question here in the last line. Mm-hmm. So you said that the inner product is anti-linear. Why did you took out the G without the complex quantity?
Because I'm assuming that actually I'm dealing with a real product, yeah. And this is when usually you talk about a metric, because these things will fail if it is complex and not real. Okay, time to erase something. Or maybe I can continue here. Okay, as a small exercise, we said that we can expand a vector psi in this way. Now we want to show that the covector dual to that will just be given by this. So can I ask you to take 2 minutes, like 1 minute, to actually see that this is true? It's not such a great exercise. I will do it. So let's say we are taking the scalar product between psi and another vector chi. Then we know that I'm just rewriting psi here. I didn't do anything special. And now the scalar product is antilinear in its first argument. So psi I conjugate has to come out. And this is nothing but psi I star AI chi. So I can take this first part and identified psi I star identified with the covector. But you also know that psi can be expanded in terms of the dual basis vector. So let's call this let's call this psi bar I, EI. And I'm using E again because we have shown that these are the dual basis vectors. Why is it a bar? Yes, thank you. Although I like bras and cats, I keep writing them in the wrong way. Thank you. But we know that this was defined as the covector dual to the basis vector E times the inverse metric. So if I compare these two expressions, I actually see that this psi I bar that I defined over there should just be GI, the other way around. My psi should be here. Psi I star should be GIJ times this psi bar. or equivalently, so I went through all this just to justify that starting from this linear combination of basis vectors, I end up with this linear combination of covectors, which justifies why I am going to represent a bra by a line. So not a lot of space here. But psi can be written as a line vector with components psi I star times E1 En. So just in terms of notation, I always choose to put things which have an object, an index up into column vectors, and things which have an object down into line vectors. And this makes the notation consistent. So in the basis, this covector is represented by this line vector. And the one thing that we haven't done yet is write operators as matrices. So okay, this is the last thing about representations of vector spaces. So just as an example, let's think of rotations on the XY plane. So if I start from a vector xy and I want to rotate it by an angle phi, I can think of this operator or this matrix acting on the components of my vector. So this is an example, just to remind you where you have seen this before. And now, in general, if A is an operator acting on vectors in the vector space V and taking them to another vector space W, and let's say the dimension of V is N, and the dimension of this other vector space is M. And let's say this vector space has a basis EI. This one has a basis, I don't want to confuse this with my dual basis, a basis FI. OK, what is A going to be? Well, let's think of how A acts on the basis vectors. So when A acts on one basis vector EI, it must take it to some vector in this other vector space, which means that I can expand this in terms of the basis vectors of W, and let's call this, so I'm going to have the vectors J here, and I need to FJ here, and I need to be summing over the index J, and just to specify that this is the action of the operator on the I basis vector, I need another index I there. And it's even better if I write it in this way, so that you can see that if you put the basis vectors in a line vector, this thing here should be a matrix. A21 and so on. Then this will give me so these are the components of the matrix representation of the linear operator. And I'm not going to show this now, but you can check that if you think of A as acting on the components of a vector, so if I think of A now acting on a linear combination of basis vectors, then you can see that this actually turns into this expression. So you can think of A now as acting on the components II, and this explains why we usually say that the matrix representation of an operator acts to basis vectors to the right, whereas it acts on components to the left. Right? So this is something you might have seen. And I know this must have been quite confusing because it was quite random, but I think that this concludes my very quick linear algebra review. It wasn't really a linear algebra review. It was just a selection of a few things that I think you will find useful to review. So any question on this? Okay, if there are no questions, let's. Yeah, of course.
Over here, on the right of this board, when you've written A, so aren't you. Your index is lower.
Was that the question or no? What are you, sorry.
It was about the indices.
Here, why I've chosen to write the indices like this, one up, one down?
No. I got
it. Somebody else, a question about this?
That's the question.
Yeah.
So I'm a little confused, because the way I've usually seen it is like not mixing index notation, bras and cats, so like,
mm-hmm.
I guess, like, I look at that object and see that that's a scalar, but it's not. So I don't know, could you comment on, like, maybe how they interplay?
Okay, so let me see. So you've usually seen just this on its own, for example, or
yeah, like that would be.
So you're thinking that this whole expression is a scalar? Is this what you're saying, or
No, I mean, I see that it's not, but I guess I'm confused. Like, I guess I wonder why it's more advantageous to write it like that, or whether there's usually the FJs or kind of implies.
So once you write it like this, I think once you specify your basis, then you don't need to write this down each time, and you actually just write this. So you're saying that you know, I have a vector with component psi I act on it with an operator, and this takes me to new components psi j, right? Very good. So I guess I wrote this just to justify this expression, but when you write this, you always have a basis in mind. The idea is precisely that if you change the basis, the vector should not change, right? If I have a vector pointing here, I can rotate my coordinate system, but the vector should actually still be here. And this is why the coordinates of the vector will change under a rotation of the coordinate system, for example. Does this answer the question? Yeah.
One thing that was missing is so we invented dual space so we can have vectors, so we can define an inner product. But now we have covariant or contravariant indices in both dual and regular space. That still corresponds to how they transform, they transform this covector.
So when we were talking about components of vectors, contravariant should really mean components of vectors, and covariant should really mean components of covectors, of dual vectors.
Right, but can I have them both transform covariantly and contravariantly depending on whether I do raise or lower the indices?
That's right. So if you have a metric, you can raise and lower indices, and then once you have a covariant, for example, object, you can immediately construct a contravariant object. However, if you don't have a metric, then these are objects that are defined separately. So starting from a contravariant object, you only have that unless you have a metric, and then you can create something else.
Can you give an example of a case where I couldn't have a metric?
Let's say theoretically, when you don't always define a metric, you can work with those two spaces independently. So, other questions? So I've been giving these lectures. This is the third year I give this lecture. And every year, the linear algebra part becomes shorter and shorter, mainly because the feedback I get from the students every year is that most of this was already known. There is no reason to explain it in so much detail. But unfortunately, I feel that my presentation is becoming more and more confusing this way, because it's getting shorter and shorter. So I'm sorry if this seemed, I don't know, quite random. I hope that the rest of the course will make a little bit more sense. So for the last 10-15 minutes, I'm going to skip on to group theory. Okay, so perhaps let me not write the definition of the group on the blackboard, but refer you to your notes. So a group is a set with a binary operation. But okay, let me just write for. So in general, I would be, I will refer to the elements of the group as G, and if you, the most important property of the group is that if G1 and G2 belong to the group, so does their product, and the group needs to be associative, it needs to have an identity, and it also needs to have an inverse. Okay, so let's start with finite groups. And perhaps you can tell me what finite groups you have seen so far. Permutation? Okay, very good. And the cyclic group. That's right. So actually, what I will be telling you about today is just a little bit about the permutation group, because there is a theorem that says that every finite group is isomorphic to a subgroup of the permutation group. So on that note, just to introduce these concepts, let us think of a lattice and symmetries in lattices, and let's say, for example, I have a triangular lattice, and to make it even simpler, let's just say I have a triangle, and I am interested in seeing what the symmetries of this triangle are. So let me label the vertices as 1, 2, and 3. And now, what kind of transformations can I make here so that the triangle actually stays in place? Well, I can do rotations on this plane, of course, I mean. So for example, I can take this vertex and put it there, this vertex, put it there, and this vertex, put it back here. And this kind of transformation is usually denoted by 1, 2, 3. So this means that 1 goes to 2, 2 goes to 3, 3 goes to 1. This is a cycle notation. If I repeat this one more time, so this takes my triangle to 1, 2, 3. Now, if I rotate again, I guess this would be a rotation of 120 degrees, then what's going to happen is that 1 goes to where 3 was, 2 goes to where 1 was initially, 3 goes where 2 was initially. So this is the element 1, 3, 2. And then if I make another rotation, then I'm actually back to where I started. So I'm going to write this as the identity. So you might recognize this as the cyclic group. I think this is correct. So 1 goes to where 3 was, 3 goes to where 2 was, and 2 goes to where... So the idea is that 1, 2, 3 times 1, 2, 3 is the same as 1, 3, 2. So this is the cyclic group with 3 elements. However, these are not the only changes I can make here. I can just exchange 1 and 2, which corresponds to, if you want, a reflection around these axes, or I can exchange 2 and 3, and 1 and 3. And if I put all this together, so if I take the union of C3 along with these changes, 1, 2, 2, 3, 1, 3, then I have constructed the full permutation group S3. So the permutation group S3 describes all possible permutations of three objects. And let's change here. Okay, just to, because maybe not all of you have seen this notation before. Let me just say there's another way of writing the element 1, 2, 3, for example. I can use two rows here. And in the first row, I'm going to put 1, 2, 3 in their usual order. And then in the second row, I'm going to write what 1 changes into and so on. So 1 goes into 2, 2 goes into 3, 3 goes into 1. Is an equivalent notation for writing this element of the group. Okay, if I study symmetries of the square, just for completeness, let me write again what rotations would be here. So let's start again with 1, 2, 3, 4. And now if we rotate again 90 degrees around the center of this square, we are actually going to go into 1, 3, 2, 4. So when we use this notation. We write things in cycles. So in this case, this would be 1, 2, 3, 4, whereas this is 1, 2, 3, 4. So in this case, 1 and 3 are interchanged independently of what 2 and 4 do, and 2 and 4 are interchanged independently of what 1 and 3 do. That's why we write them as two cycles, right? And then let's see, this would be 1, 2, 3, 4. This would be 1 goes into 4, 4 goes into 3, 3 goes into 2, and then the identity. So this is, again, the cyclic group, whereas if I do all possible permutations, and this would be the permutation group S4, this would be all the elements of C4 plus all other possible permutations. For example, I can only exchange 1, 3, and leave 2 and 4 where they are. And actually, you can see that this element, that this group has 24 elements. And perhaps the easiest way of seeing this is, let's write the general element of this group in this notation. So this is the general element, whereas 1, S2, S3, and S4 are some permutation of the numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4. But they can never be the same. These should always be distinct numbers. So how many choices do I have for picking S1? I have the number of choices is 4 for S1, 3 for S2, 2 for S3, and only 1 for S4. So this is 24. So there are 24 elements in this group. In general, we can generalize this to the group Sn, the permutation group of n objects. This includes all objects of the form 1, 2, up to n, and S1 up to Sn here. It has n factorial elements. And as our friend already said, sorry, I haven't learned your names yet, the importance of the permutation group is that all finite groups are actually isomorphic to a subgroup of one of these groups. So tomorrow we're going to start with infinite groups. And let me just ask you to quickly look over what a homomorphism and an isomorphism is for those of you who don't remember those definitions before tomorrow. Okay, any last questions? Well, as I said, if you do come up with any questions before the lecture, I would appreciate an email. Otherwise, we start tomorrow again. Thank you.